Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi. And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of January 22nd, 2016. I always have to think, right? Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Great. Well, it's wintertime here in what passes for wintertime here in the Boston area. We're looking at a little bit of a snowstorm this weekend. I hear the mid-Atlantic states down Baltimore, Washington are going to get hammered. The mayor of Boston has volunteered to send two snow throwers down there, or state-of-the-art snow throwers. That's all great. Great. But DR, there was some big news about global temperatures in 2015. And yes. The context for this is that for the last God knows how many years now, 10, 12, 15 years, the deniers have been saying that there's a hiatus, that is to say the temperature has not been rising. So DR, tell me, what happened in 2015, the year just concluded?
Well, 2015 is officially, according to NOAA and NASA, the hottest year on record. And in fact, NOAA reported that 2015 is Earth's warmest year by the widest margin on record, which makes 2015 a record, as Brad Friedman has noted. NOAA reports 2015 broke 2014's record by nearly 0.3 of a degree, or 0.29 degrees Fahrenheit above the previous record. And there have also been projections. I believe the UK Met Office is projecting, as well as other climate-related organizations, that 2016 may break 2015's record. So you would have three consecutive years of the hottest year on record, which means that, you know, things are getting off.
I heard some famous politician on the radio saying that when she grew up in Arkansas or lived in Arkansas, there was a saying that said, if you see a turtle on a fence post, that you know the turtle didn't get there on his own, right? Exactly. So if you have 3 years in a row of extremely high global temperatures, you have to start wondering that it's not just some random coincidence, huh?
Definitely.
So, DR, tell me, what sort of media coverage was there of this world record temperature?
Not a lot, unfortunately. I saw there's a small bit of coverage on CNN's website, a bit of coverage on the CBS Online's website, but there was also a lot of coverage on Al Jazeera America, which is ironic because sadly Al Jazeera America this April is scheduled to go out of business. And one of the ironies is that Al Jazeera America was financed by the government of Qatar, even though they did some great climate coverage. They was financed
Funds of Qatar, right?
I think there's a specific term for a government that's basically financed or running off oil. And it's been reported, and fairness and accuracy in reporting has noted, and Tom Hartman has noted, that part of the problem that's going on is that the government of Qatar has been struggling due to a financial downturn caused by the disruption in the worldwide oil market, and the irony of that causing Al Jazeera America and its great climate coverage to basically go offline. It's sad.
It's irony abounds, huh? Yeah, well, I watch Al Jazeera occasionally. They certainly had good climate coverage, but they, you know, it's a weird thing. On my TV, it was down in the old-fashioned, it wasn't high definition, and everybody looked a little funny, and you'd go down there once in a while, but they weren't able to make it, huh?
And the doubly sad irony is that Al Jazeera America purchased, you know, obviously Al Gore sold Current TV to Al Jazeera so they could form Al Jazeera America. So you had one venue that could have provided more climate coverage being sold to becoming another venue that did is now going offline. So essentially the continued imbalance of the in terms of the coverage of this issue remains a problem.
Well, you know, you and I are still standing. We are not funded by any sovereign state investment fund. We do not have billions of oil dollars behind us, but we will continue to try and discuss the news. Anyway, so 2015, hottest year on record by a record amount. Read it and weep. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I wanted to touch on, DR, is something that we touched on last week, but I think it deserves its own little moment in the sun explicitly. So the context for this is that during the State of the Union, the president hinted that somehow we as a country needed to find better ways to manage the federal land, basically the fossil fuel resources on federal lands, and make those make that management take into account the consequences for the planet of the extraction that was a lot of dancing around, but basically was hinting at a kind of a keep it in the ground philosophy. So tell me, what happened last Friday that was more definitive than ramblings in the State of the Union?
The Obama administration announced that they're going to put a pause, a delay. They're going to suspend the coal mining lease program on public lands as they're considering an overhaul of the program that could basically result in a raising of the fees that are charged to energy companies to do the extraction. Basically, the idea is that they're going to consider a new program that will factor in the social cost of carbon. And there is some speculation that the fees could be raised so high that it will basically make it unaffordable for energy companies to try to exploit the coal on public lands. This is sort of a halfway measure in the sense that a lot of activists are basically calling for the Obama administration to completely ban the leasing of all fossil fuels on public lands. But now this appears to be a move towards a de facto ban by just making it so unaffordable that the energy companies basically say, hey, we can't go for this. We'll basically lose money instead of making money.
Well, I mean, we have ended this show for the last several years by saying that the United States must put a price on carbon. So I'm content. I mean, I don't think we need to ban anything. We just make fossil fuels pay their fair share of the damage, and we'll see where the chips fall, right? So I think
obviously the argument in favor of the ban is that it's a sort of a stronger measure than simply a de facto ban. A de jure ban is more of a strong signal that you're committed to ensuring that dirty energy stays in the ground.
Well, I take your point. I would say that's maybe I should rethink what I'm been thinking about. So just as a follow on, well, the other thing from last week that I wanted to at least touch again is the very good point that you picked up on for a report that came online just as we were going to recording our show last week, was about the Clean Air Act and the Paris Accord, and something that Joe Rome, who is, if you don't read Climate Progress, you should, that Joe Rome put up about the connection between the Paris Agreement and the Clean Air Act. So tell me, DR, say again, even we talked about it last week, but let's rehearse or reprise again what that whole story is.
Yes, Joe Rome noted that Section 115 of the Clean Air Act makes a reference to international air pollution, and essentially what Section 115 holds is that that under the Clean Air Act, the EPA has the authority to regulate anything that is essentially an international pollutant. So because carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are international pollutants, the Clean Air Act authorizes the EPA to essentially regulate, and there is some latitude to how to regulate. So in effect, Section 115 of the Clean Air Act can work as a de facto carbon tax. The EPA has the authority to basically implement a cap and trade program or a carbon tax in the state in order to reduce international pollutants. So basically the takeaway is that is that, 7 years after the failure of the cap and trade bill in the House, there is essentially already on the books climate change legislation. So it would just be a matter of whether or not the EPA basically uses this authority established in Section 115 of the Act, and obviously there'll be sort of backlash to that, but presumably, with the right legal rulings, that backlash will be overcome.
And I think that the interesting point from my perspective was that this clause, number 115 in the Clean Air Act, basically is unleashed if the EPA administrator, that is to say Gina McCarthy, if she determines that other countries have shown reciprocity, that is to say, if there is, and for me that's really important, because it doesn't mean that you have to have a fully signed treaty, right, passed by the Senate in order to make this thing work. If you have an agreement and the administrator of the EPA says, yeah, I see reciprocity, then she gets to basically enforce stronger limitations. And this, I think you said again last week, DR, that this goes in parallel with the president's Clean Power Plan. Right.
Exactly. And it's kind of funny, when you talk about all the clean energy jobs that would be created by virtue of pricing carbon, when you hear people run around and there was one of the presidential aspirants is now calling the EPA the Employment Prevention Act. This would be the Employment Promulgation Act because of all the clean energy jobs that would be created. So it just shows you the difference between campaign rhetoric and reality.
So DR, the last thing, climate news bounces all over the place and it keeps evolving, and we are sort of at the forefront here. But last week, we talked about a legal case out in the state of Washington, I believe it is, where some climate hawks basically blocked a train. They physically put their bodies in the path of a train that was carrying coal or tar sands or something across the state of Washington. They were arrested. The defendants proposed to use what's called the necessity defense. Right? It's something, it's not quite as bad as the Twinkie defense, but it's a defense that says they had to take this action because there was no other way that they could achieve their goal. And the judge allowed it. So for the first time, climate hawks got to put into the legal proceedings the argument as to why climate change is a bad thing. Right, DR? Mm-hmm. So you take the story from there. What happened at the very end of the trial, and then what happened after the trial?
At the very end of the trial, the judge instructed the jury not to consider the necessity defense. And after deliberations, which lasted, I believe, less than a day, I think, the jury came back and ruled that they were guilty, that the Delta Five, they were guilty on misdemeanor charges, but they were not guilty on obstruction or trying to delay trains. Essentially the trespassing charge carried a sentence of up to 90 days in jail. The defendants spent one day in jail and they received a suspended sentence for the other 89 days, as well as 2 years of probation. And four of the defendants will also pay about $500 in fines and fees. And afterwards, there's a video on YouTube of some of the jurors meeting with the defendants in the case, and the jurors basically saying that they were happy to have been educated about the risks of climate change, but based on the explanation that was given by the judge, they had to essentially render a guilty finding on the essentially.
I mean, they would have acquitted based on the data if the judge had allowed the necessity defense.
Essentially, yes. and the jurors made that quite clear.
And they did. The jurors then did the least punitive solution they could find.
Exactly, and it's being hailed as a victory because, even though the necessity of defense was thrown out, essentially, they weren't the Delta Five weren't subject to
the full
prison
penalty.
Sentence that say Tim DeChristopher got when he faced his civil when he faced his trial for on similar civil disobedience actions.
Well, we will have to leave it there on a high note that the climate hawks out west basically. got away with their actions, that the necessity defense at least a little more plausible than it used to be.
Definitely.
And anyway, what we'll do, DR, is put up links to most of the stories we talked about on the blog that's associated with this podcast. It's at massclimateaction.net/blog. Please visit us there. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. That'll bring you a link right to the blog, and you can listen to the SoundCloud widget from there. Mm-hmm. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. And, of course, you can find us on iTunes. Just go into the podcast area and search for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our duty, our patriotic duty, as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.
Very cool.